The aim itself is fairly straightforward, which is to close down King's North Power Station.
To the 300 to 350 show, the weekly programme that campaigns for a safe climate, made for Resonance FM in London and distributed to community stations around the globe. This week we preview the Camp for Climate Action that starts on 3rd of August, situated near the King's North coal-fired power station in Kent. Later we'll be hearing from Conor O'Brien, one of the camp's media reps, but we start by taking an introductory look at the problem of large-scale biofuels, also known as agrofuels, which provide a joint focus for this year's camp, with the Day of Action targeting the industry on the 6th of August. As well as being a forced solution for climate change, in just a few years, the large-scale production of biofuels has helped push up food prices, causing food riots around the world. This led to Jean Ziegler, the outgoing UN Rapporteur for the Right to Food, to condemn biofuels as a crime against humanity. Earlier this month, a secret World Bank report was leaked to the Guardian newspaper, which blamed biofuels for causing most of the increase in food prices. I spoke to Deepak Rugani of Biofuel Watch, and the first question I asked him was exactly what the World Bank had concluded.
It was saying that the 75% of the reason behind the increase in food prices was due to biofuels. And it was trying to differentiate that from other drivers of food price rises, such as increased meat consumption in India and China, and the increased amount of desertification that's happening in different parts of the world as climate change is starting to hit. So if you take those factors out, what they were suggesting in this research report was that 75% of the rise in food prices could be directly attributable to industrial agrofuels. And the result of that increase, has been that a further 100 million people are going hungry. So we're talking about a massive human casualty as a result of not even a doubling in food price overall.
Before that report came out, the most common figure I heard was 30% of the rise in food prices was attributable to biofuels. Mm. So the World Bank one is much steeper than that.
Much steeper, absolutely. And you wonder where these assessments come from. The US had produced a figure that was as low as 3 or 4% attributable to biofuels. I think one of the fundamental questions we've got to ask ourselves is what's driving the increase in food prices? And if you look at the three categories I mentioned, the increased amount of desertification is happening, but it's very, very small scale at the moment. In terms of the world productivity of world food production. If you look at increased meat consumption, it's happening in pockets in some areas of India and China, but it's by no means a national phenomenon in either country. Biofuels is a completely different order of magnitude. Not only is it happening in the EU, in the US, in China, and in Australia, a massive demand for biofuels, but you're actually having it mandated and specific targets set, which means that there's a guaranteed return on any production of biofuels that feeds into the market. Now that means when there's a guaranteed return, it's a risk-free investment. And you're seeing big venture capitalists putting in billions of dollars into this industry. So the two are incomparable, and common sense would tell you that the World Bank report is likely to be much nearer the truth than say the US government statistic I mentioned earlier.
The Gallagher report also seems to be downplaying the role of agrofuels in the recent food price process.
Yes, I feel it's no surprise that it is. The Gallagher report by the Renewable Fuels Agency, essentially it's an agency set up with a remit of implementing the Renewable Transport Fuel Obligation. So it has a specific bias at the setup. You know, people who describe it as an independent review, I mean, I would question that quite seriously. I mean, people on the board members include people like Gareth Llewellyn from National Grid. Now, he's linked to BlueNG, who are the energy generating company who have been driving the first CHP power plant to get planning permission, which is to be driven on biofuels in East London, despite very significant local opposition. So there's a strong vested interest. You've got other people like Greg Archer, director of the Low Carbon Vehicle Partnership, and Paul Jeffries from BP. This is not only not an independent review, but you can see it's already being steered by the driving force of industry and the vested interests that they themselves represent.
So there seems to be an increasing amount of reports out there assessing the impact of agrofuels. Some of them even suggest that they are good for climate change, but there are some that suggest that they're not. Why are there such a wide range of opinions on this?
I think the starting point is to recognise that it's called full life cycle carbon accounting, and it aims to assess the amount of carbon emissions from producing, say, bioethanol or biodiesel along the full life cycle of the growing of the plants, the transportation to the refinery, the energy used in the refinery, the transportation to the fuel pump, and then the final burning. And the suggestion is that there's less carbon emitted than there would be from burning fossil fuels. And all sorts of industry research projects are afoot trying to prove just how much they reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the most problematic area about this, and this is really a sleight of hand that the industry is using, is that they don't include the indirect impacts to do with agri-fuel emissions, which are right at the heart of the problems that we're seeing now, and they dwarf the amount of carbon savings that you might see in an ordinary life cycle assessment. So in terms of indirect impacts, I'm talking about things like displacement of agriculture and peoples into forests, which means that you could actually be destroying a rainforest, or destroying a grassland, a savanna, all of which contain vast volumes of carbon, both above the ground and below the ground. If you don't quantify those, it makes the carbon life cycle assessment a complete nonsense. And the other obvious one is to do with nitrous oxide emissions. We know that it's 300 times as powerful as CO2 as a greenhouse gas. It's a massive contributor to warming. And in terms of emissions from biofuels in Europe, by far the greatest pollutant is nitrous oxide, not carbon. So when you look at it with that frame on it, it makes a mockery of the whole assessment process.
Any growing of agrofuels will involve some land clearance or displacement of...
Yeah, you're right. It's either going to be displacement of agricultural land, or it's going to be directly taken from natural ecosystem. Those are the only two choices available to us. If you take it from natural land, of course, those people get displaced, and you can suggest that an equal volume of natural habitat will be put into food production. If you go directly into natural habitat, of course, it's having the same effect. So whichever way you square it, for every hectare of agri-fuel we're producing, you could say that we're destroying a hectare of either arable land or natural ecosystem.
There was one report from Science earlier in the year that weighed in with a massive impact, potentially, of CO2 released from land clearances.
Yes, I imagine that's the Faglioni report, which suggested it would take up to 840 years of continuous cycles of growing oil palm on peatland in order to compensate for the amount of carbon that was released from oxidising peat and removing the tropical forest that was originally above it.
When you've given the example of the peatland, which was probably the most extreme,
yes,
but other land clearances of natural habitats also will release CO2.
Well, that's right. Yeah, peat is the most destructive. But if you look at tropical rainforests, of course, they emit vast volumes of carbon. But even relatively innocuous-seeming natural ecosystems like savanna and grassland hold vast amounts of carbon underneath the soil. They've usually been intact since at least the last ice age. So when you do start cultivating them using modern agricultural practices, you're straight into the oxidation of soil-based carbon. And the same situation is accentuated even further when you start draining wetlands like the Pantanal in South America for agri-fuel production.
I was shocked to hear recently from somebody that you were sharing a platform with that a massive land grab appears to be taking place right across Africa, where agribusiness companies are doing deals with governments to set aside 10%, maybe 20% of land for biofuels, and that will result in people being dispossessed and will impact on people's food security as well. This is bit of an untold story, it seems.
Yeah, and this is just the tip of the iceberg, what's happening in Africa. It's actually already been happening in South America and in Indonesia and Malaysia and now in India as well. To give you just one example, 30 million hectares in India is now being described as wasteland. It's not wasteland at all. It's used by peasant farmers. It's used by pastoralists who migrate their livestock over this land periodically during the year. It's anything but wasteland. But once given that name, given that label, it allows big multinationals to go in and quite simply take that land, and that's what's described as a land grab. So this is a problem that's happening globally.
And presumably this land grab will result in people being dispossessed from land that they rely on for subsistence farming to actually feed themselves.
Absolutely. It's their land, and the one thing they do have is the independence of knowing that they are able to feed themselves often comfortably during the period of a year. What's happening now is that they're losing what's called food sovereignty, this capacity to use their land the way they want to, which is primarily for the production of food. And making no mistake about it, industrial agriculture has always removed from people food sovereignty, the capacity of choice for how they what they grow on their land and primarily to feed themselves. So agrofuels is an expansion of a highly damaging model of industrial agriculture, which effectively usurps people from their land in a way that's very reminiscent of the colonial days.
And have people started to estimate the number of biofuel refugees that there might be as a result of the policies that the EU are now talking about in terms of mandatory amounts of biofuels?
Yes, the Forum on Indigenous Peoples, they talk about some 60 million people being biofuel refugees as a result of the targets we're setting, but that figure is quite likely to grow.
You've already spoken a bit about the Gallagher report, saying that the people that actually produced it were largely industry people with a particular interest, but they ended by concluding that a slowdown should be the way forward rather than just to stop production of biofuels as a bad idea altogether. But on the other hand, there seem to be increasing calls for a moratorium or sort of some other kind of legislative or policy moves that will bring production of agrofuels to an end.
It's just ridiculous, quite frankly. When you look at the volumes we're talking about at the moment, globally it's about 1.5% of road transport fuels come from biofuel. In the UK it's even less than that. You're still talking about multiplying it 400 or 500%. Now the current volumes are causing devastation in key areas of the world where ecosystems are critical, not just to biodiversity, not just to the lives of people in those regional areas, but also to climate change. And I'm particularly thinking of retaining the stability of the Amazon, which is very potentially prone to large-scale deforestation at the moment, which could ultimately lead to collapse. So we've got very significant problems in terms of ecosystem degradation, which could ultimately become much, much worse. And we're having that at such a tiny fraction of current percentage usage. You know, the EU call for moratorium has been going for a year now. NGOs in the US have been calling for a moratorium since last December. Again, Africa, last December, the NGOs there called for a moratorium. And we're seeing a whole host of calls for an end to the use of land for agrofuels throughout India and throughout Latin America. They're not calling them moratoria, they're calling them by other names, but it amounts to the very same thing.
That was Deepak Raghani of Biofuel Watch, and we'll return to the issue of biofuels later in the series. Although agrofuels are the subject of a day of action on Wednesday the 6th of August as part of this year's Camp for Climate Action, the main focus for this year's camp is the government's support for a new generation of coal-fired power stations, despite a personal plea from one of the world's leading climate scientists, James Hansen, and in the face of a massive coalition of campaign groups in the UK under the banner of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition. I spoke to Conor O'Brien, a media rep for this year's camp, to find out what was being planned. In a sense, the camp has already started, hasn't it? There was a big event kind of kicked off from Heathrow on Sunday. There was a big public meeting, and then there's the caravan. Can you tell us what's been going on?
Yes, well, the idea is that there's a caravan linking Heathrow to King's North to show that, you know, the issues are connected and that we still support the campaign against the third runway and our position against aviation remains the same. So we wanted to maintain a degree of solidarity with the work that we've done last year. And at the same time, go through the various communities in and around London that are going to be affected. For example, last night there was what was known as the Climate Putney Debates, where they took a bit of historical background from the ancient Putney Debates, not the ancient, but the old Putney Debates during the Civil War, and resurrected that for a night of talks and discussions around climate change.
So people are moving on foot and by various low-carbon means all the way from Heathrow down to Kent, where the camp's going to be over the course of a week?
Yes.
What can people expect who come to the camp if people haven't been there before?
There's a lot going on. For example, there's a whole massive program of workshops covering various issues of politics, campaigning, low-impact sustainable living, preparing for the day of mass action. That's the main focus of the camp. But within that, the camp's going to be divided into various neighbourhoods based on various geographical locations around the country, like, you know, the Midlands, West Yorkshire, Manchester and so on. So people can come along and meet people in their own area, camp with them, and just get to know them. Same time, there'll be other events going on, there'll be other protests happening, and large plenary debates where the larger issues about how we react to climate change, both nationally and globally, will be discussed by panels of speakers.
There's 5 time slots throughout the day and 11 workshop spaces, so there's potentially up to like 50 workshops a day or something.
Yeah, you're basically going to get everything and anything is covered, well, from art, dancing, to legal side, to pure practicalities of confronting climate change, what we can do personally or nationally as part of a larger group.
I mean, the workshop program starts on Monday and goes through, I guess the focus kind of starts to shift towards the kind of direct action training is for people that want to get involved in that as the week goes on.
Yeah.
And there's a big day of mass action on the Saturday. Can you say a bit about what the aim of that is?
The aim itself is fairly straightforward, which is to close down King's North Power Station. That's the ultimate goal. But within that, there's 4 separate strategies. Probably the most widely publicised is the Raft Regatta, where people are encouraged to build their own rafts, and we're going to get on the Medway and sail down to King's Norton itself. For that, there'll be quite a lot of training provided, life jackets provided, and so on. There's also 2 land groups. There's what's known as the orange and the green land blocks. Green are people who are just going to go across fields and try and get in, while the orange pod, is going to be more of a festival-style approach. Highly colourful, lots of entertainment going on, and marching to the front gates of King's North, peaceful and calm manner.
What's the legal status of all this year? Because I know that E.ON applied for some kind of injunction at the High Court. What became of that?
Well, they got the injunction, but it's not something we're particularly worried about. It basically says people shouldn't trespass on their land, but as things go, Drax had an injunction, Heathrow had an injunction. And to be honest, it's just King's North and E.ON dotting their I's and crossing their T's. We don't expect it to have any impact on our actions or on the camp itself.
Do they own much land surrounding the power station, or is it just within the actual power station itself?
It's just within the power station itself.
Right.
They're not a large landowner.
Right, so people can't be arrested for being in the area around the...
No, the injunction itself doesn't cover the camp at all. It's just the power station, so people can quite happily come to the camp and have nothing to do with the injunction.
I mean, there's always a worry about how these things will be policed. What are your feelings about how that's going to go this year?
I had a chat with the police liaison group, and we do actually talk to the police to iron out the issues. And the feedback I've been getting from that is it's been going very positive. The police have been communicating with people, you know, just saying, like, these are the busy roads at these times, so if you want to avoid mass disruption the same way that it was at Heathrow through the policing. This year should be much more relaxed.
In terms of the kind of wider campaign against coal, which seems to be pretty solid, I mean, you've got scientists such as James Hansen in the States, and, you know, the Royal Society here, for example, they're saying new coal without any form of carbon capture and storage is going to make it difficult for us to meet our emissions targets in this country. And then you've got the whole Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, which is a massive civil society coalition, also opposing new coal build. Where does the camp and the non-violent direct action approach fit into all this, do you think?
I would say that we're bang in the middle of it, really. King's North was picked because it is such a significant target, and because now is the moment, really, when coal becomes a major issue. By stopping the plans for King's North, we'll have huge knock-on effects for the 6 to 8 other coal-fired power stations that, you know, the government's planning to have built. So you've got the scientists, as you say, you've got the large NGOs, and we're the other side of the coin, where the people are engaged in the civil disobedience and dealing it purely from a grassroots, showing that it's not just a few scientists, or it's not just the NGOs who are concerned about this issue, it's just ordinary, everyday people who are coming down to say, look, we don't want this to happen. And what we're doing is demonstrating to the corporations and the government that, you know, there is massive grassroots resistance to these plans, that these aren't the solutions that are going to save the planet.
I mean, what's the main value of this type of campaigning? Do you think it's the way in which the issue can be ratcheted up the media agenda almost, so that people sitting in front of their tellies at night can't ignore the issue?
That's one of them. I would say we're a bit more ambitious than that. While we certainly want to raise, you know, the public profile of coal, and as we did with aviation last year, and just get people thinking about it generally, we also want to empower people themselves. We don't want to leave the solutions in the hands of the government or in corporations. We're not a lobby group from that perspective. We want to empower ordinary people, local campaigners, individuals of all stripes and all backgrounds to actually say, right, climate change is affecting everybody. It's affecting me. It's affecting my family. I've got to do something about it. And that's very important to us. And that's why in our timetable, there's a lot of workshops to actually show and discuss how people can do that.
What's the reaction of the local people to all this? I mean, I know you've been doing one or two public meetings down there. I think WDM held a public meeting recently with a written statement from Robert Redford as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, from speaking to the people who have been doing the public meetings, the feedback has been quite positive. Now, naturally, there is concern by locals when you're about the amount of disruption this will cause to them, but, you know, we're going out of our way to actually meet and address those issues. So I suspect that once we set up that there'll be quite a few locals coming down to check us out, as happened in Drax and Simpsons, Heathrow.
And what's their attitude to E.ON and to Kingsnorth? Do you know what the proportion of the population support a new power station there, for example?
As far as I'm aware, there hasn't actually been any studies done of that. In terms of being a local employer, they're not a significant player, although since we did announce that they were going to be the target of this year's climate camp, they've pulled out the stops on their PR battle in terms of sponsoring local events. So clearly they're quite concerned about, you know, their reputation and how they're pictured by this whole event. So, you know, actually by going to Kingsnorth, we're opening up the debate within the whole community down in the Hoop Peninsula about climate change, about the power station, where they wouldn't have really considered it before. So I think they're going through quite a learning process at the moment.
A bit more about maybe different ways that people can be involved in the camp if they come along.
Yeah, people can get involved as much or as little as they like. Just to take through the process, people are welcome to join the caravan. Now, at the end of the caravan, the final bit is actually going to be the march to the camp and to Kingsnorth. Just the final, right, we're now open and ready to happen. And we want as many people as possible to come down and join in. It's going to be quite a festive atmosphere. At the camp itself, people can come along and just enjoy themselves. But the way we structured it is the camp isn't run by a group of people. It's run by everybody who's there. So we have these neighbourhoods, and these neighbourhoods form the decision-making process. So everybody who comes along can have a say, can have a voice in what they would like to see happening or how things should move and change through the camp. On a practical level, there's plenty to be done. You can learn how to do plumbing. You can learn how to do cobble ovens. You can learn how to build compost toilets. There's loads and loads of jobs that need to be done. So the camp is open to everybody. We want people to come down to explore, to learn, to get involved. We're open, welcoming, and we're a cross-section of the people in the country. Everybody will find something at the camp that will appeal to them.
And the website is very extensive, isn't it? I mean, pretty much all your questions should be answered there, really.
Yeah, we've put a lot of work into the website, which is www.climatecamp.org.uk. Everything you need to know is on there.
That was Conor O'Brien of the Camp for Climate Action, and as I was writing this script a few minutes ago, news came in that the site for this year's camp had been successfully taken. That's it for this week's programme. Please visit the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.co.uk for links and references relating to this week's show, or to hear this week's programme again. We're going to end with a song entitled Soul Not Coal, written for the camp and sent to us by the Corbin Town Crier, who apologises for the ragged performance, complaining that he ran out of time as he is now on the caravan to King's North. Don't forget to take a look at the Climate Camp's extensive and comprehensive website for further information, inspiration and independent media coverage as the week unfolds. And check out the huge education programme. George Monbiot, Mark Linus, Caroline Lucas are amongst the high-profile names featured, alongside representatives from Christian Aid, trades unions, Carbon Trade Watch, Transition Towns, Hands Off Iraqi Oil, Greenpeace, World Development Movement, Platform, Friends of the Earth, Leave It in the Ground, and many other groups. There's workshops on the food crisis, China, carbon capture and storage, veganism, carbon offsets, reforestation, off-grid renewables, oil and debt, Kyoto 2, carbon rationing, the Niger Delta, soil, climate science.
Are you ready to cry? take some soul to block that King's North coal. And it could take its toll, but it's a righteous goal. Heaven.